call Mr. Grant Stalker, which is sitting on my left. His evidence has been prepared in writing and circulated. There's only three pages, so there's no summary. Four pages, there's no summary. He's happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
Your evidence in relation to the subdivision around the base of Slope Hill, at 3.6, you make the point that the condition of Slope Hill's only been able to be kept as it is due to the income from the rural living subdivision around the base. Is that the point that you're trying to make there?
Yes.
Yeah. So. What's the hope for an ONL like Slope Hill once the flatland subdivision stops? How do we look after those kind of landscapes if we don't have the income coming in from the subdivision into the future?
The income that has come in to date has been able to make it affordable for us to put things in place to continue to maintain that. As part of our enhancement for our own rural lifestyle living as well.
Thank you. My only question.
Commissioner Walker?
No, I have no question.
Seeking answer, of course, for Commissioner Coombs, as if someone comes along to subdivide again, a piece of land, a part of it includes Slope Hill, there's always the opportunity to. Covenants and controls.
Okay. Do you want me to read this out?
No,
it's finished. Yeah.
Okay.
That was
quick. At least you're ready. I take it Mr. Stalker can leave if he wishes to.
Yes.
He
should
stay on the general conversation. Likewise, Commissioners, again, relatively short brief, again, has been circulated in writing. I think Mr. Reid has a couple of corrections he wishes to make to the evidence.
Yep, just a minor word being replaced in error. The report refers to a market commentary. It's got the word community for some reason in three places.
So that is
2.9, 2.2, and 2.10.
What are we deleting, sorry? What are we deleting?
Changing community to commentary.
To be marked a commentary, not marked.
Aye.
Just one other final point, Commissioner. At the break, I was somewhat chastised by a couple of my witnesses about my comments about how many 500 square metre houses there are on the basin. Mr. Reid, you could have had to the panel in the last 12 months in terms of the houses you've valued. How many would be over 500 square metres around the floor area?
It's not a stat that I've kept, but I would have thought it would be 25% would be over 500 square metres.
This is. Ground floor only.
Ground floor.
Total size.
That would still be probably pretty much size.
And 25% in numerical terms, what is that?
Roughly. In 12. That could be. 10 or 15.
Thank you.
that's the 25%.
Answer any questions, Mr. Reid?
In paragraph 2.7, houses this is the construction cost of 8 to 10 million. Sorry, that's all right. I don't think that's worth asking. No, I don't have anything. Thank you.
Mr. Reid, 2.6, you've got a discussion in there about the sizes of land parcels that people are looking for. You talk about a range between 4,000 square metres and 2 hectares. And I've often heard that real estate people will tell you that what people are looking for is the last thing that they've sold, because of course that's what was available. To what extent is what's on the market skewing your view of what people would want if they had open options for lot sizes?
For the reasons I'm putting them before, I don't think a lot. Since you get to a larger allotment, I think it creates some difficulties or to manage and maintain. So if you had, like, you go from 1 hectare up to a 2 hectare site and you're starting to have pet sheep or something to keep the grass down, or you go from providing a lawnmower to a tractor, I think the maintenance required lifestyle blocks often refer to as anti-lifestyle blocks. And firing one myself, and quite a few hours in a weekend going through maintaining those blocks. So the bigger you get, I think you start moving into different requirements. So and there's plenty of people that would like a larger block for horses or wanting to actually have some stock. But I think people enjoy having a space, having that sort of smaller block that gives them enough privacy. They can block out their neighbours with plantings. They're not shaded by their neighbours, and the sites aren't a sentence of the whole weekend being spent maintaining and mowing. And I can think of one example on Lower Shotover Road of a friend that I don't see that much anymore, but he did tell me that he spends 5 or 6 hours mowing his lawns, and that's probably about a 3 hectare site.
So in terms of your experience in the Waikato Basin, what would be that absolute sweet spot in terms of a land parcel area for a rural lifestyle product that people might look for?
I think it's quite evidenced by the sales in the last 3 or 4 years, and some of the first ones to sell out were the Waterston subdivision on Tucker Beach Road, which was between probably about 4,500 square metres up to about just under a hectare. And then the popularity of the Hawthorn Triangle, those sites, probably circa 1 hectare. And the purchasers of those are people that work in town, have families, and that's what they, I think that's where the sort of demand has been. And it's popular, suits that purpose, from what I discussed before.
Okay. And would that be different for the rest of the district?
I did get some sort of questions or possible questions for me last night, so I did give that some thought. But I do some work in Wanaka and lifestyle and larger stations and evaluations like that. I think Wanaka is quite similar to Queenstown and the sort of some of the popular areas and higher value subdivisions are actually probably around that sort of 1 hectare size, which would be Mount Barker Road and some of the sites close, very close in the front of the town centre. I do think Glenorchy is probably a little bit different. I think people like a more open feel and do prefer and want to have stock and animals around them. And some of the subdivisions up there, I think, have been quite popular due to the sort of larger size. But I dare say there's people that don't like looking after that size as well.
Okay, thank you.
Just one more.
Yes, thank you. Interesting on your comments that the people moving into these sections are generally from town, so your experience is that there's a lot more, that there's a reasonable number of people from within the district looking for that size property?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who move from residential locations, work their way up the property ladder, and that's their aim to have sort of like a couple of acres of 1 hectare and that sort of lifestyle property. And there's, you know, a lot of the houses are reasonably good size houses, and probably, you know, most of them predominantly would be over $1 million spend for a house in landscaping.
I guess my question was more, are they property residents who are looking for these particular rural lifestyle pots, or are they
out of town? Residents, I think, predominantly. Whereas I think a lot of lifestyle previously was also owned by non-residents. I think that's slowly sort of changing.
And also, have you had any clients who have asked specifically for that size lot? But for it to be more productive land, as we sort of describe rural land to be, in terms of to actually produce something on that land?
But I don't get people coming and asking that question, but I do know from an evaluation point of view that rural land in the Waikato Basin and quite a lot of Wanaka is not feasible to buy at their market rates and farm and get a return of, get a return, even if you pay that much, given balancing the books would be hard enough. And I've just gone through that exercise on a property in Wanaka, probably about 800 hectares.
Might depend what they were proposing in terms of product and what they wanted to fund.
Like a sort of like market garden, horticulture sort of thing. Don't really see much of that anymore. I know there's a bit of that when the district plan required a use to be put in, and so there's a lot of acorns or a lot of different sort of crop plants being planted around the place. I think that was a means of getting a building platform. I can't really name any off the top of my head any market gardens or anyone that's tried to put something into production.
Alright, thank you.
Just in your
answer to Commissioner Coombs, you said, as I understood it, that the range of section sizes that were sought were largely in the 4,500 square metres up to just under a hectare. Was that in the Water Tipping Basin? Was I right in understanding that?
Yeah.
To what extent is that demand driven by the price differential caused by the size? In other words, are people going for the lower end because it's a bit cheaper compared to buying 2 hectares, for instance?
There definitely would be a price hindrance on larger lots. I have completed analysis, like I analyse our larger sales to the building platform value of 1 hectare and have a residual. In the residual, I usually take at a higher rate up to 4 hectares or the next 3, so to a total of 4, and then above that at a lower rate. And some of those residuals vary around the Wataru Basin depending on contour and aspect, what it sort of offers, but they could range between probably 100,000 and 200,000. So to buy that extra hectare, you're talking 100,000 to 200,000 in general. And that probably goes up to 3 hectares, and then the rate will drop a little bit after that.
Is there a big differential in that about 4,000 to a hectare between the smaller sites and the larger sites, or is it just that's just purely a function of location and view and outlook, etc.?
Yes, I think so. I don't think there is a large variation between that.
Okay.
But as I said, it would come down to the shading and the location of neighbouring properties. I think it would have a lot to do with it.
Again, the Commissioner's, Mr. Baxter's evidence is a little bit short. I've also deliberately included the earlier brief given in Hearing Sumo 1. This would benefit the Commissioners who weren't there, so particularly the new evidence is 2 pages. Given that, there is no summary prepared. I'm just going to put Mr. Baxter, given the rest of the discussion, a couple of questions. And first is, what comment he'd like to make on the issue of 500 square metres ground floor area in terms of numbers or percentages of houses. Can you just comment on that, Mr. Baxter?
Yes, we're unaware, involved obviously with a lot of development like that, and I think go through Mill. If you take Millbrook houses, for example, I know it's not rural, but it's in an open landscape out there. There are houses out there, 600, 700, 800 square metre houses regularly. And I'm aware of a lot of houses over 500 square metres. And to be honest, I've got some confusion about this this discussion around if it's over 500, it's really big, because what's happening out there is that you could one could find very hard to tell whether it's a 300 or 600 square metre house when the design controls have them broken into those sort of pavilion forms. So I think we can think about a 700 or 800 square metre house sitting up on the edge of a cliff in Auckland with a vast swimming pool in front of it, two stories high. And I'm talking ground floor area, not second floor. Or our 700 square metre houses, 550 square metre houses that are actually have those Otago pitch roofs, which are written to most design controls, which actually keeps the building small, you know, with the roof pitch, and with those flat connections, which is our standard building. And we end up with these little collections of pavilions. I could show people photographs of houses at Millbrook and they think, oh, that'd be 250 or it's 800. So I think that this worry about these big houses at 500 square metres larger than it, I think that worry's overblown, sir. No, I think it comes down to what the design controls on them are.
Just on that issue, Mr. Baxter, if, as I understand the plan, it proposes that 500 square metre houses would be permitted, the only design controls proposed are to do with the exterior materials and colours. So that breaking up into pavilions would not be required for those. So are you suggesting that when you get over the 500, the pavilions are a useful thing, that the design controls which are causing that breaking up are helpful to ensure that they're not appearing to be too large, or that there should be no distinction?
I think that it would be good to have something where, which addresses that, which has been in there by default anyhow. The original design controls written in this value, which I wrote 20 years ago and used all over the place now, really started from wanting to give the impression of a farmhouse collection, like the shearers' quarters and the, you know, those little broken forms, which you can see repeated right through all the houses now in the triangle and things like that. So it works on larger houses, I think.
So
there'd be no harm in having something which addresses a house over a certain size.
Right. So if for instance there was a rule which said when you exceeded a certain size, then you had to abide by certain design controls of the nature that you're talking about, would that be, from your point of view, an appropriate outcome?
Yes, it would be. Yeah, with the intention to reduce the visible bulk of the building, or the perceived bulk of the building.
Thank you.
Second issue, Mr. Baxter, having listened to Mr. Reid, can you offer any view on the size of lots that your clients or other people are looking for in terms of rural living?
Certainly not large. I mean, it's all about the location and the site. I mean, generally our larger lots, so let me come back. We're starting a master plan on a 15-hectare lot. You may want three lots, so they're located in certain places to do with assessment matters. You invariably have to have one lot, which is the big daddy lot, which actually has to have the sheep to look after it. But yet the ideal lot that we're looking for is anywhere between 2,000 and 8,000. And I know I'm going smaller, so I should say four up and above, certainly not 2 hectares. I live on 6,000 square metres and I spend an awful lot of time cutting and blowing and mowing and it's far too big for me. So the ideal, we get asked to do between 4,000 and 8,000 square metres, say ideally. That's it.
Otherwise, it's next. You start answering questions from the panel, please.
Thanks for your statement, Mr. Baxter.
much of your statement is repetition of evidence that you gave at the earlier hearing, which is helpful to me because I wasn't on the on the strategic chapters. You've critiqued Dr. Reed's characterisation of the Waikato Basin, and then done your own. And so, if I could summarise, I guess it'd be fair to say that your general view is that she's focused a lot more on the natural attributes of the landscape and less on the cultural overlays. Your view is that that's how Dr. Reed has approached her characterisation of the...
Yes.
So that, and then you've provided your own characterisation as a sort of a counterpoint.
Yes, correct.
To that. So out of your 9 bullet points that you used to describe the Waikato Basin, 7 of them are focused on cultural overlays and only 2 on the broader, wider, open natural aspects of the landscape. So between the two of those, got one which is more naturally based, and then yours which is looking in more detail at the cultural overlays over the broader landscape patterns. Would you say we've got some balance between the two?
Yes, I think that mine was more focusing on Dr. Reed's assessment, and I think you can look at, come back on it there. One that, I don't think it's, I don't think we should be counting bullet points on here, because one of the bullet points I say is a mixture of visible open spaces, predominantly the Roche Motonais and small paddocks. Last time we've gone, well, I've just, and 2 lines of this describe 2/3 of the Waikato Basin, which is that the open rising land, which is unbuilt on. So I think, I think between Mary and Reed, I mean Dr. Reed and myself, we cover all the bases.
Yes. Okay. And the impression I get from your list, if you like, is that there's more of a temporal component. We've got land that's been subdivided and planted that is yet to come into its own in terms of giving us a clearer picture about what that long-term character is.
Oh, I think so, absolutely. I mean, I talked about the triangle and all these, and there's trees out there that are forming, thousands of trees out there that are 5 metres high that are going to be 30. So it's a pretty young landscape.
Yeah. So in terms of that, you discussed that at paragraph 20 of your evidence. Are we getting...
This is paragraph 20 of the first log.
The evidence that you've prepared for this...
Yeah.
For this stream of hearings, are we heading towards a situation where the maturation of that planting and the extent of it is going to mean that we're going to have to start to cull some of these trees out when they get too big for rural lifestyle living?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's a really good one to look at is Dalefield Hill, which is a 40-year-old example of rural lifestyle. And it's the only real established one we've got as a good example of rural lifestyle. It's there. Yes, you may have to cull out some of the trees, you know. On a 1-hectare lot, there's usually enough separation. But having said that, I just have to get my neighbour to take down some of his trees. What tends to happen on smaller lots than that, 4,000 square metre lots, rural residential. In fact, we've just done the latest one, which is over Wanaka for North Lake, the 46 lot rural residential on Albury Road, and we wrote in very strict design controls in there to control and keep view shafts open, separation, so that on a 4,000 square metre lot, you can't have the same treed landscape that we have on a 1-hectare lot for the very reason that you talked about, which was shading and influence on that. So I don't think we're going to have those problems at the moment, because the young landscape I referred to is probably best described as the triangle, and they're basically 1 to 1.5 hectare lots. We'll wait and see.
Further questions?
That's it. Thank you. Mr. Scott. Once again, the question is 3.5 pages of evidence, there's no summary. Mr. Scott, if you could answer any questions, please.
Sure. No. Thank you, Mr. Skelton, for your statement. You get quite focused towards the end of the statement around an appropriate separation distance between houses and the rural lifestyle area. And you come to a specific figure of 65 metres as being an appropriate distance between houses. Can you just take us through how you got to that figure?
I was asked to come up with a figure to figure out an appropriate separation between residential units in a rural lifestyle zone. And in coming up with that, I did examine Dale Field as an example. So I had a good look at Dale Field and figured out what the existing pattern of development was there. And it was more of a personal experience in being in these zones, separation distance. I basically looked out the window and tried to gauge the distance that I felt would be appropriate, and where, if it was completely open landscape between two dwellings, where that threshold may exist, and 65 meters would seem to be an appropriate distance. 50 seemed a little bit too close, and when you started to get beyond that 65, 75, 100, that was beyond that threshold of privacy. You could be outside and not feel like you were invading your neighbor's privacy if you were 65 meters away. So it was a personal experiment, as well as looking at the existing residential pattern in Dale Field.
Okay, so when you said you looked out the window, did you do any spatial analysis in terms of pulling out property files or looking at overall plans and measuring the distances between houses?
Yes, in Dale Field, that's what we did. I didn't have access to the specific building platforms, so I actually used the aerials on web maps and tried to gauge an average distance.
Okay, and you mentioned that was in an open landscape when you didn't have planting. Is that the parameters around 65 metres?
That was what I used to determine as sort of a baseline. If there was nothing planted between dwellings, what would be the appropriate separation between the dwellings?
Okay, and we've just heard from Mr. Baxter that there's a tendency to plant up these rural lifestyle lots.
Right.
And that planting is still growing, even from 20 years ago. Have you done similar analysis on an appropriate distance between houses when there is planting in between?
Well, the density of the planting would be a factor of that. If you had a hawthorn hedge that was quite dense that you couldn't see through, then the separation distance could be shorter. Than if you had, say, more of an amenity planting of sort of rural character trees with pasture below them, then there's going to be more of a visual, more permeable visually. So I hadn't carried that out. No. I'd look specifically at in a more open landscape.
Okay. I'm wondering if the answer to that question might be more important than the first question about an open landscape, given that we're hearing that when you get to that size, Mr. Baxter's identified the importance of clearly defined curtilages for planting around the house and then open space in between.
Right. Can you repeat the question then more specifically?
It wasn't really a question, it was a comment. I'm wondering if that's the more important answer, because we're seeing a requirement for planting around the curtilage of houses at that sort of scale of lot.
There's other factors too, such as sound, that would definitely come into play there. So even with planting, the planting's not going to necessarily mitigate the noise. So that's another indication.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you for the evidence. We've had some conversation about rather than the minimum lot size of 1 hectare, an average lot size of 1 hectare. What are your thoughts on that?
My evidence is based on a minimum 1 hectare. But I suppose when we are talking about an average, what that would allow would be more of a clustering of residential areas and leaving more open space in places where that open space may be more valued, for instance, corridors along public roads. So allowing for something that's more of an average does permit that more cluster development, and it allows for more open space, because if you're talking about a minimum and you have a certain lot size and a minimum inside of that, then it becomes more, I guess, regular in pattern than if you were talking about an average. Then you could have a cluster at sort of, say, the bottom of a site, and then more open space closer to the highway could be, or to a corridor or a place that you want to protect could be maintained. And then that brings into sort of what Mr. Baxter was speaking to, is to just maintaining that more open space.
Could you see any particular negatives of adopting that frame?
I suppose residential amenity could be something that could be affected when you have people that are closer to each other. What it does allow is that more of a master lot, in fact, like Mr. Baxter was talking about, where somebody could control the balance of the land and the landscape management would fall on one property, which would allow individual lot owners on the smaller lots to have less land that they need to manage. Negative effects, yeah, I think residential amenity could be something that could be adversely affected.
I wonder when the two left.
Just had a question before we deal with that. So, in terms of that potential clustering, given that the author of plan full discretionary approach in the rural general zone allows that opportunity, are there any examples in the district, particularly in the Waikato Basin, where clustering has occurred and large areas of land have been set aside and maintained as open space that would provide examples for us?
There's one in particular that comes into mind is Stonewood, I believe, Stone Ridge, north of the Hawthorne Triangle, and that's along is that lower Charlotte Road. And that's a place where there is, it's quite a large, I'm not sure that the area, quite a large area of land, and everything between the more public roads is left in open space, and then I think there's 4 or 5 residential units clustered towards the center of the site, and that whole site had been master planned, and I think it got through on that merit.
Mm. So that was 4 or 5. Is that the one that has a pond of Mr. Goldsmith that is that you took me to look at when I was looking at the Hawthorne Triangle?
If I could, Mr. Skelton, it's in the northwest corner of the triangle on the main road in Speedgrassland.
Yep.
And Bob's Cove could be another example of that, where all of the more open lands adjacent to the Queensland Glenorchy Road are retained, and then developments clustered towards the less visible, less sensitive part of the site.
Can you remind me where Bob's Cove is?
Bob's Cove is about 10 kilometres on the way to Glenorchy.
So it's not in the Waikato Basin?
No, sir.
I interpolation, Mr. Chairman, is going to be that I took the view that minimum versus average was a chapter 27 issue, and you will give evidence on that specific issue when you get to chapter 27. Mm.
But it does relate to the minimum density as well, of course.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes. Question about the minimum distance. We put Mr. Skelton specifically to have a minimum on that open basis as a concentric. That was the thought behind the minimum distance, so that for example, there was mature landscaping in between, then someone applied for consent, and it's less than 65, someone applied for consent and say, well, think of landscaping in between so you can go down to 50. That was the kind of thinking behind that. Provide a minimum amount for a consent trigger that would enable neighbour amenities to be protected.
Okay, so those numbers contained within your suggested edits to the provisions, or?
That's a good question. No, I don't think it is. It was just put to. The concern was in an established rural upstate like Dalefield, if you went from 2 down to 1, might somebody suddenly get a house right next door? That was the concern. So the question for Mr. Skelton was, provide a minimum distance that couldn't form the basis of a consent trigger.
Okay, so you see, just a minute, if we did go down to 1 hectare under the rural lifestyle area, then we could set a minimum distance of 65 metres across an open landscape, and it could be cut back to 50 if there was intervening planting.
The suggestion is more simply that there's a trigger within 65, regardless of the circumstances, you must apply for consent and notify your neighbour.
Okay.
Which gives the neighbour a chance to either object if they're worried about it, or you go to a hearing and say, well, it's only 50, there's a hawthorn hedge in the middle. It doesn't matter. That was the purpose of the question, Mr. Skelton.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think we're down to Mr. Kelly. Okay. Commissioners, this is the aspect of Mr. Powell's evidence that relates to rural living.
So, sir, I just had one correction for my evidence. Page 36.
Page 36.
Page 36 is my evidence. In two places, the first paragraph and more importantly in the last paragraph, there's just an incorrect reference to the rule. The title is correct. But in the first and last paragraph, they agree with rules 22.5.3. That should actually be 22.5.12.1. Consistent with the heading on that page. Commissioners, as I did on Tuesday, this is pretty much a summary of the key points narrowing what's in my units in relation to rural living, what's the basin matters, and just to confirm that I have read other evidence that's been put on the website, which has helped inform my current thinking, reduced here. First point I'd like to make is that through my evidence, there are recommendations made in the Sector Control Report which I support, and I have listed those. Paragraph 2, in my opinion, the most appropriate way to implement the purpose of the Act, the strategic direction objectives, as amended in my evidence in chief, is to ensure the socio-economic benefits of the rural living development in the Wakatipu Basin are recognised and provided for by inserting a new objective policy in Chapter 21 and by amending various other provisions in Chapters 21 and 22. And I may have set out in paragraph 3 below, which I'll read. The primary reason for this is because, in my opinion, the existing rural living character of the Wakatipu Basin is not disputed in any landscape evidence, and this should be recognised through the adding provisions. There was high demand for rural living subdivision and development in the Wakatipu Basin, but the PDP, in my opinion, does not provide specific policy guidance relating to the Wakatipu Basin. The Wakatipu Basin has the capacity to absorb further subdivision and residential development whilst maintaining and enhancing amenity values and the quality of the environment in terms of Section 6 of the Act, and without adversely affecting any Section 6 values. The potential for further subdivision residential development basin is supported by landscape evidence, and there appears to be no evidence before you that I'm aware of that justifies, at least in respect of Section 32 considerations, why further appropriate subdivision and residential development in the basin would be inappropriate. Finally, providing for continued recognition of rural living development in appropriate parts of the basin will achieve an efficient and effective use of resources in accordance with Section 7B of the Act. As said in my evidence in Chapters 21 and 22, I think they should be amended as follows. And then, Commissioners, it's just a list, a summary list of specific recommendations that I make to those amendments. And I've given you specific reference to the page numbers of my evidence where there's more detail about those. Just to reiterate, I think there's a new objective policy should be included. Turning to point C, I think the assessment matters should be tweaked. So paragraph D, I think policy 22.2.2.2 should be deleted. And certainly, I'll include my evidence, I've given the page number, the discussion we had at the last hearing, and my position around the urban growth boundaries. In terms of sub paragraph E, F, and G, these relate to tweaks to the rules, or changes to rules, which we've been discussing today in the hearing. And that's a summary of my evidence pertaining to this document.
Could you just assist us, please, Mr. Farrell, by telling us which pages in your evidence you're specifically dealing with? It'll just make it quicker for me to find.
Sure. Pages 4 to 7. And I'm looking at my contents page. Pages 4 to 7, page 12, page 14, page 15, page 17, pages 29 to 32. And then everything related to Chapter 22, which is pages 33 to 37.
Thank you.
Can I ask any questions, please, Mr. Farrell?
Thank you. Just clear. On page 12 of your evidence, Mr. Farrell, the new objectives that you've set out there. Probably heard me ask other people this. What's the environmental outcome that's being sought? The goal that's trying to be achieved?
Provision of rural living, number one. Whilst ensuring that the effects on landscape character and amenity values are appropriately managed. Maintained, so.
Is it providing for a method?
I would say the method is how you provide for it.
And what's the detail in terms of appropriately maintained? What's appropriately mean?
In that case, sir, that's allowing the framework to be on a case by case basis. It's recognising the subjectivity of those section six values, character and amenity values. So I think it's very, just to explore that a little bit, I think it's very difficult to be prescriptive around what might be appropriate when it relates to section 7 matters in respect of amenity values, including character.
Paragraph 47. The first thing I'm going to do is correct whether it's, is this to do with this one or is it real journeys?
It's this one as well, sir. That was both.
Okay. Oh no. It's all right, I've already asked those ones, so no, keep nothing good.
Inclusion of 2C to specific zones, or do you mean right across the basin?
I mean right across the basin.
So, further subdivision and residential development right across the basin, not specifically within rural lifestyle or rural residential zones.
Correct, so it's across rural general, rural lifestyle, rural residential.
Okay, thank you.
Also
outside
the OAL, which
is
evidence is all
been directed. Yes, I should clarify that, and it was certainly clear in my evidence in chief that discussion doesn't apply to
the United States. Okay. Yeah. It was almost so obvious I didn't ask it.
I was trying to make sure. Because the basin normally is the whole thing, you know, it's the basin.
Yes.
We're talking about the bottom of the basin.
I think we should refer to it as the floor of the basin.
Or the basin.
More logical.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
And then 3E in your summary, talking about allowing for 500 to 1,000 square metre building platforms, and that was a controlled activity. And based on the evidence of Mr. Baxter, Have you given us an indication of those matters of control that you think should be taken into consideration?
I haven't given it to you.
No.
I think Mr. Baxter announced the questions talked about breaking up the form of the building and that sort of pavilion and type of thing. Do you accept that those types of
things? The plan, the rule itself, is for a discretionary activity. And I haven't been specific about what matters of control that would be, but my anticipation was that it was just dropping the class down to control, then applying those matters.
Okay.
As a matter of control rather than discretion.
Quite the same, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Just one more.
Yes, I have to ask. You mentioned a couple of times the socioeconomic benefits of rural women and rural myself. Can you highlight or just note what the social benefits are for women for this style of living?
Sure. First and foremost, it provides a type of accommodation. And my wife and I have just moved to Queenstown over a year ago. We can't have enough to find a house in the living area. And yesterday we just settled on a rural residential reception. So there's one that applies directly to me at a personal level. It enables housing. Ages 4 to 6, particularly paragraph 13 on page 5, lists benefits, particularly the third bullet point. And whilst the first paragraphs or subparagraphs repeat the economic benefits, within each of those economic benefits, they indirectly will result in social benefits through indirect spend.
How's that social benefits?
You're allowing people to do things with money, basically. Money is used. It's what facilitates transactions and people to do what they want to from a social point of view. It doesn't deliver, basically. Pretty hard to live without money. Just exploring point sub point 3 on the bottom, provision of housing, enhancing resident and visitor amenity values and appreciation of the district. In my opinion, that has a social benefit around improving a sense of place, strengthening community characteristics.
That's a much better answer than
the previous one. Still maintaining money. And one that hasn't been discussed directly, but certainly I see the social benefit, which I listed on page 36, paragraph 156, which I'm seeing more and more in the work and clients that we have, is the ability to provide housing where families can live together or in close proximity to each other. And I think there are numerous intangible social benefits with allowing families to live together, particularly older generations. When they have the grandchildren and the children come to stay, they like to live in places cooling state. And I think there's one social input that doesn't really reflect up in the proposal.
And just one other query, page 14, your second to last bullet point suggests that there's a double up between the use of ecosystem services and nature conservation buildings. The definitions for these and the definitions chapter do highlight the difference. Have you considered the differences between them and why they double up?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
No, I haven't.
So we can possibly excuse that comment without a further analysis.
Yeah, I guess I read it on the face of it without delving into the actual definitions. It'll seem to be my preference in terms of drafting a plan that, unless it's a very obvious difference, to look to the line.
They are in the definitions chapter.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Thank you for talking.
Just looking at your page 37, where you discuss the density change, are you able to point us to somewhere in your evidence the in any empirical data you've used to come to the opinion that a 1 hectare density is better than any other density in a rural lifestyle zone?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Are you able to say that 1 hectare density is better than any other density?
Yes, on the basis that reading this as a rule, which is to give effect to effective policies, and bearing in mind my evidence is based on the need for additional provisions of objective policies that recognise the benefits of providing for more rural living or providing for rural living in the district, in the Waikato Basin. I think it goes without saying that if there's a 1 hectare average or minimum, you will get more benefits than if there is a 2 hectare average.
Now, you heard my discussion earlier with Mr. Goldsmith about this concept, structure planning for the Waikato Basin as an approach. What view would you have on such an approach?
A highly supportive one. I've had clients who including some of these clients that will say in their opinion, why didn't we just have a referendum? Why hasn't the council asked me about providing for subdivision or not? Can't we just talk about this? As opposed to using the district plan process as a means to have that discussion. In other words, I think there are landowners in the Waikato Basin that would prefer an alternative planning process or some type of consultative process to discuss what the future Waikato Basin might look like, and one that doesn't involve a district plan process.
Do you think that such a consultative process, which would obviously form part of the structure plan, would be limited to only consulting the landowners in the basin?
No, I would expect it to be fully public.
Okay.
Thank you.
I've got no further questions. Anyone else?
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
I think, sir, that's the. Finished with ours, just made it.
Yes, I did listen. Very pleased. And I have to thank you for choosing an amount of time that was more than adequate. That is more important.
Did you want to spend 5 minutes on that Ms. Barnes memorandum so I can come back to that?
Do you want to off the top of your head or would you like to write it down? That might be more helpful for us if you would write it down and see the sentiment. That would be more helpful. If I make notes, I may not get it for you. But we will adjourn until 2:30. Yeah. 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 Yeah.